Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, sponsored by EarthX, the world's largest environmental experience, and also sponsored by Natural Awakenings magazine. Live your healthiest life on a healthier planet. Now here's your host, Bernice Butler.
Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. We are now in our fifth season, and this is the new year of our fifth season. And we are more excited than ever to continue to help you explore and understand that unbreakable relationship between your health and the health of the planet. Here we look at the hottest topics related to our environment and its sustainability and how they affect your health and wellness. Here, issues like climate change, plastic pollution, extreme weather events, and others will meet up with everyday impacts like allergies and asthma, digestive issues and gut health, cancers, lung, heart issues, and more. So listen in today as we interview experts for today's show about the Lancet Countdown Report on Health and Climate Change and COP28. And this is something that we do the beginning of every year because they're very important subjects, and we want to make sure that everybody understands them and understands their significance. So on this first show of the new year, we are so excited and honored to talk about something that is so vital to the quality of our new and upcoming year, and something that in and of itself is so very important to how we navigate this new year as well as future new years. It's so very important to us, and it's really at the heart and the essence of Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio and our mission to help you explore and understand that inextricable relationship between health and planet. And at the same time, it also helps us meet our goal of being explainers in chief, which is what we like to think of ourselves. So the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change report is kind of like the Super Bowl of health and climate change impact analysis, and like the holy grail of evidence-based science and research connecting these two existential components of our lives and our world, that is health and climate. It's essential for everyone to take note of reports like the Lancet Countdown Report because they provide vital information for tackling some significant public health issues caused by climate change. Climate action needs more buy-in at all levels, especially local, where decisions are made that affect life closer than ever before, and they affect our daily lives more than ever before. So combining strong political will with actionable evidence-based recommendations from scientific experts will make all the difference in protecting our planet, protecting ourselves and our families, and ensuring long-term sustainability for future generations of our families. As well, this report helps us recognize and understand what we already see and feel that's happening. It kind of helps us unpack it. So let's get started. So here today to help us explore and unpack the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change report is Dr. Jody Sherman. Jody is Associate Professor of Anesthesiology of the Yale School of Medicine and Associate Professor of Epidemiology in Environmental Health Sciences and Founding Director of the Yale Program on Healthcare Environmental Sustainability in the Yale Center on Climate Change and Health. And Dr. Sherman also serves as the medical director for Yale New Haven Health Center for Sustainable Healthcare. She's a member of the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change and co-leads the Lancet Commission on Sustainable Healthcare. Welcome, Jody. Did I get all of that right?
You certainly did. Thank you, Renee.
And thank you so much for making time to join us. So we want to start out by you telling our listeners a little bit more about what the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change really is. What does it mean to and for ordinary people in their everyday lives? And then how did you come about being involved in this report?
Sure. The Lancet Countdown exists to monitor the links between public health and climate change and the transition from health threats to opportunities. That's really important that there's opportunity here to make a difference. So we're a global collaboration of over 200 leading experts from academic institutions and UN agencies across the globe, bringing together climate scientists, engineers, energy specialists, economists, political scientists, public health professionals, and doctors. And my specialty within this is as a physician. Each year, our findings are published annually in the medical journal The Lancet, ahead of the United Nations climate change negotiations, which was the big conference of parties meetings that just happened in the United Arab Emirates. Our data makes clear how climate change is affecting health, the consequences of delayed action, and the health benefits of a robust response.
And how did you, Jody, become involved in the Lancet Countdown Report?
My specialty is really on the pollution impacts from healthcare delivery itself, how we can mitigate those emissions, and also adapt to more resilient and sustainable healthcare systems. So I've been working for the past 15 years on measuring and mitigating the health impacts of healthcare delivery itself and how we can transition and make that more sustainable, which is our duty to do first do no harm in healthcare. And the Lancet Countdown, recognizing that healthcare's contribution and response, both in terms of how we take care of the health implications of climate change and environmental degradation, and also the fact that we're an enormous industry and contributing to the problem, they're the ones who identified the topic of interest and brought my team in as leading experts.
Indeed. You know, most of us never get to the thought that healthcare itself creates environmental impacts. And certainly, it's substantial. How would you describe, or are there any stats on the environmental impacts that the healthcare industry creates or causes?
Yes. Well, it stands to reason. Healthcare is an enormous industry. It's 1/5 of the economy in the United States. It's 10% of the global economy. It's an enormous part of our industry. And therefore, it makes sense that it's going to be contributing a substantial amount of pollution. In fact, it is. Our findings of the Lancet Countdown have indicated that globally, in the most recent year, we've been contributing this to the Lancet Countdown for the past 5 years. Globally, the healthcare industry contributes between 4.6 and 5.2% of total global greenhouse gas emissions, just from the delivery of healthcare itself. And 1/4 of that comes just from the United States, even though we are only 4% of the population.
Why is that? I've seen on this program, as you know, we highlight different environmental themes each of the 12 months. And with most of them, the U.S. is a major contributor. But why is that so with healthcare? Because everybody administers healthcare to some degree or the other.
Right. Well, it is certainly well known that we have a lot of inefficiencies in our healthcare system. We spend more per capita on healthcare than any other nation in the world. We know that about 1/3 of our healthcare goes for wasteful, low-value practices. And so essentially our system is pretty bloated. At the same time, 11% of our population lacks insurance altogether. Half are underinsured. And it's not, let me just emphasize that this problem of low-value care waste is not unique to the United States. It's not even unique to high-income countries. It's a pervasive issue. How we improve the value of the care that we provide, it is a pervasive issue, even in low-resource settings. The U.S. is known to be an outlier.
But could you explain that a little bit more, what you mean when you say, I think you termed it low-value waste? Yeah, what is that?
Right. So low-value or wasteful care, so care that is ineffective, inefficient, unwanted, you know, those are things that are low-value care as opposed to things that are effective, needed, wanted, efficient in their delivery. So that would be high value.
What are some examples of that low value care?
Yeah, so unnecessary blood testing, unnecessary x-rays, scans, unnecessary prescriptions. Historically, the biggest example of this is antibiotics for childhood ear infections, which we know are predominantly viral in nature. So this is medication that we know is not being effective, but historically was given more to comfort parents than anything else, until it was realized that antimicrobial resistance or the fact that these drugs are becoming ineffective for everyone. So that's a problem of the commons. And so it is our duty to be stewards of those resources. And that's just one example of a medication that was historically given inappropriately. So really trying to focus on high value or appropriate care is really an important means to help mitigate not only healthcare pollution, but costs.
Yeah, and we haven't talked about one. Usually on the, well, not usually, every year we also deal a whole month of shows on waste and waste management. And you haven't used that word, but I hear it all over some of your conversation, too, in terms of healthcare.
Right. Well, let's just say waste has several different meanings. It really behooves us to try and be very clear what we're speaking about. So wasteful, meaning inefficient, is the terminology I've been using. Waste, meaning the stuff that we throw away and then have to manage, whether we burn it or landfill it or try to recycle it. That's a whole other problem
right, in
and of itself. Taking mostly consuming things unnecessarily, inappropriately. That's really what I'm focusing on now, because we need to really move upstream to be as efficient and effective as possible to minimize unnecessary consumption of resource. And this is really certainly highlighted during the pandemic, that we, even though we live in a wealthy country, resources are limited. And just because we don't feel those limitations or feel those shortcomings doesn't mean they don't exist. We certainly felt it during the pandemic, but it turns out that there are not enough supplies, medical supplies globally to meet needs. You know, insulin being a big example, where there are several million more patients than there is annually produced insulin that require diabetic patients. And so there's an example of where patients are dying because we can't provide enough medication.
Indeed. We need to go to break here shortly, and we've got a lot to unpack on the other side, because I really want to talk about, I'm sure there was a lot of learning and impacts from COVID. We'll be right back on the other side with Dr. Jody Sherman as we talk more about the very important Lancet Countdown in Health and Climate Change Report. Thank you. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, The Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, natural grocers, all central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is North Haven Gardens, serving the Metroplex since 1951, the most respected horticultural establishment in North Texas, offering gardening and plant education, concierge services, DIY classes, gifts, and more. And our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 40 years with a holistic approach, non-mercury, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. To today's show on the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change Report for 2023 and information on the COP28. And we are back with in the first part of our show with Dr. Jody Sherman from Yale, and she is making us so much smarter about the Lancet Countdown report. And again, thank you so much for joining us today, Jody. So start out this segment. Tell us about some of the main findings and messages of the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change for 2023, and perhaps how they differ from previous reports, or what you, in your expertise, consider perhaps the most significant aspect of it.
Right. Well, some key messages, I would say, you know, four very important key messages that follows, including that this year's health stockade reveals that climate inaction is costing lives and livelihoods today. We are already seeing the impacts of climate change. We are at 1.14 degrees of global heating. That's average surface temperature compared to pre-industrial levels. And health systems are more strained. And so people are getting more sick and are dying already. And every fraction of a degree difference matters. Another key message is that our projections reveal the dangers the future might hold unless we urgently act to tackle emissions now. Thirdly, the world is accelerating in the wrong direction as growing fossil fuel activities and an unjust energy transition threaten the health of billions alive today. Fossil fuel excavation is increasing. It's increasingly subsidized. That really has to be addressed. And then fourthly, there are transformative opportunities for health-centered climate action to deliver a prosperous future for all. And so this transition includes focusing on the phase-out of fossil fuels, supporting subsidizing the uptake of renewables, improving energy efficiency, certainly things like shifting to a more plant-forward, sustainable diet, and shifting toward not only more efficient and cleaner energy, but also active travel, which has health co-benefits.
Now, you mentioned about the increase in lives lost. Is there any estimate on that, or guesstimates or anything that are out there on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of data and facts that are in the report, which is free that anyone can mm-hmm. access. But mm-hmm. some highlights that really focus on vulnerable populations. So, for example, heat-related deaths of people age over 65, which is a vulnerable population, has increased 85% between the study years between 1990 and 2000. Adults over 65 and children under 1 year old are really particularly vulnerable, right? The most vulnerable, and are now exposed to twice as many heat wave days. So it's not just heat days. So it has a specific criteria that of a certain amount of temperature increase for at least 3 consecutive days.
I'm glad you mentioned that the vulnerable populations are young people, children, as well as elderly people. We do the last show that we do every year, which is like, I think, the end of October, is about children, our future. What are we doing to them? Because so often in every show, it inevitably comes up the vulnerable populations that are overburdened. And indeed, those are always low-income and minorities. It appears to me we don't speak enough or highlight enough, and people therefore don't realize enough that the elderly are very vulnerable as well as the children. I think COVID tended to uncover that a little bit. But again, I'm glad that you mentioned that. And you're saying that there's 85% more deaths in that population.
That is correct. We're also seeing not only the number of heat days, but heat-related events affecting our health directly, but also affect things like food and water security. So, for example, the higher frequency of heat waves, not only just heat waves, but droughts in 2021 were associated with 127 million more people experiencing moderate or severe food insecurity globally compared to the decades between 1981 and 2010.
Now, I want to move on to something else you said, and that was about the healthcare system being more strained. Now, we saw just a little bit of that during COVID. You, as a healthcare professional, I'm sure you saw a whole lot of it, much more than we ordinary people. But talk to us about that. How do we see that? Where are we seeing it most? Is it regional? Where does it happen? And how are ordinary people in their everyday lives seeing that and feeling that now and anticipated to feel it in the future?
Right. Well, we all at some point use the healthcare system. And so it really is to our benefit to have a healthy system that is accessible to us. And our health systems are definitely regionally impacted by climate change. So, for example, recent flooding in Texas, the heat waves and wildfires in the Pacific Northwest, and also in California. I mean, certainly in the Northeast, Hurricane Sandy was really quite famous for, knocking out several hospitals in New York City, most notably NYU Langone. These are weather-related events that are certainly far more probable, and now we have enough information to tie quite closely to their being directly related to a rapidly changing climate, fossil fuel combustion. So when these health systems go down, we have no place to go. And so populations get displaced, which then overwhelm regional centers. So even though you may not have been directly affected, the next state over and the next county over, all those patients get transferred or displaced to your health system, and then you don't have access to those resources. So that's, some examples of how climate change affects the vulnerability and the ability to provide services. And you know, it's not dissimilar to what we experienced with COVID, which obviously was a global pandemic, but the impacts across our nation were not felt at the same time. So I'm in New Haven, Connecticut. We were just outside New York City. We were about 2 weeks behind New York City in terms of the heights of our patient surges. And so whereas New York City patients were literally, you know, dying in the hallways for lack of resources, I can't imagine anything more devastating as a physician.
It seems to me, Jody, that COVID was a trial run in terms of what could be and can be the future for the healthcare system. Did we get lessons and did we take action on some of those lessons?
We certainly, you know, I wouldn't even say it's a trial run because our health systems are already being impacted by climate change here in the United States. Just not every health system is being impacted directly at the same time. So we're already having those experiences. There are lots of potential positive lessons from the COVID pandemic, including sharing of information, conservation of resources, pooling of resources, pooling of information. Those are things that help build resistance, help build resilience to our ability to respond to crises. And whether it's COVID or climate change, the principles are the same. We need to be able to be flexible. We need to be able to conserve resources. We need to be able to shift resources around, whether we're talking medical supplies or healthcare worker staff.
I have to think that the Lancet Countdown report outlines a lot of things, but are we at the point, as it relates to the healthcare industry, where we can and do take defensive actions when we know bad weather is coming? You know, like up north, when they know they're going to have a snowstorm, they go and station the dump trucks with that stuff they put on the roads at various places and what have you in anticipation of. Here in Texas, we as homeowners with the freeze, I make sure I have water, I make sure I have gas. Is that sort of thing going on with the healthcare system?
Right. So all healthcare systems are required to have disaster management, emergency response plans and protocols in place, and are also required to do vulnerability assessments to prepare. Unfortunately, those vulnerability assessments are virtually all based on historic data, and so fail to adequately predict and prepare for future events. And, you know, this is repeatedly seen, you know, NYU Langone, you know, even those lessons, you know, that they made the mistake of putting their emergency backup generators in the basements, which got flooded. But, you know, as one example, but, you know, buildings are not being built with future projections in mind by and large. And this can be overcome by working more closely with NOAA, with NASA, with the World Meteorologic Association to use hyper-local data projections. And that should be required of all facility planning, all facility retrofitting and renovations. But unfortunately, now it is not required.
Yeah, indeed. And that should be required in a lot of other areas other than healthcare, but particularly healthcare. We just have a minute to go. Jody, so I want you to have the last word and get any information you really think is important for us to know. But one of the things that you said, too, was you said there are transformative opportunities. Can you talk about that a little bit in terms of the Lancet report and what it's telling us?
I think, you know, certainly a key message is we need to get off our addiction to fossil fuels. And that means using the power of our vote to not allow our tax dollars and governments to continue to subsidize fossil fuels, which is has not only a limited future as an industry, but is impacting our own tax dollars, our own health, and the health of our children. And so that is a key message. And so if we were to shift those investments into cleaner energy, and again, also doing more sustainable food, which also is better for our health, more plant-forward, healthy diets, and again, more active transportation, these are things that have health co-benefits as well as help mitigate climate change and benefit the planet.
Last question on want to know. It seems to be taking a long time to get some vital medical services like appointments. I tried to get an appointment last week for an ENT and my appointment's in April. Is that related to climate change or COVID? And I know a lot of that's regional as well.
I think that's, I can't say that that's related to climate change unless you're in an area that was recently impacted by a weather-related event unless it's a procedure that requires a specific medical supply that is in shortage due to global production issues related to, again, related to weather. But most of our medical supplies are produced, you know, globally and sourced globally. So even if we don't have, it may not be directly in touch with weather-related events or you know, we can respond and adapt more quickly here in the United States. If our vital medications and equipment are being produced in a company that is a country that is very vulnerable, then we're going to experience a shortage.
And I think people are seeing that, and it seems to be exacerbated after COVID. Thank you so much. We've been with Dr. Jody Sherman with the Yale School of Medicine, and she's been telling us about the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change report, and she has made us smarter. Thank you so much, Jody. We really appreciate it. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today, our first show of the new year, and we're doing something that we've done many of the years, and that's look at two very important reports as it relates to environmental issues and health impacts in our country, in our world. Today, we are covering the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change. And of course, the previous part of the show, we were with Dr. Jody Sherman from Yale Medical School. And now we're going to move on and focus on COP28. And again, related, but different, but nevertheless, very important. And so this is about the recent climate summit in Dubai, again, COP28, and it marked a significant milestone in global efforts to address the climate crisis. So COP28, which is Conference of the Partners, we're going to talk more about the definition of it later, it is an eagerly anticipated meeting every year. And it brings together leaders from around the world to tackle the pressing issue of climate change. And the primary goal of COP28 was to find ways to improve the health of our planet and enhance the quality of life for everyone who lives on this planet. And so leaders at COP28 focused on adopting cleaner energy sources such as solar and wind power to replace methods that contribute to air pollution. And there were additional discussions, of course, centered on assisting the less affluent countries in dealing with the challenges posed by climate change, often which stem from the actions of the wealthier nations. The conference also aimed to establish transparent rules and plans and to ensure that everyone understands their role in protecting the environment. So COP28 really served as a platform to showcase global unity against the existential threat of climate change, emphasizing the need for coordinated action as well as effective implementation. But despite the uncertainties of our time, the world did endeavor to reaffirm its commitment to the global climate agenda during COP28. And the hope was that participants, including governments and stakeholders, would bring stronger ambitions regarding mitigation, adaptation, and climate finance with them to Dubai. And the goal was to highlight success stories in implementing commitments and fulfilling pledges. So in essence, COP28 really resembled a large gathering of people passionate about preserving our planet, working together to ensure its health and happiness for everybody. And the conference symbolized a collective effort to make promises and plans on a global scale, mirroring the commitments individuals make in our everyday lives. And ultimately, the success of COP28 holds implication for our daily existence, influencing the measures taken to address climate change and to secure a sustainable future for all of us. So here today, though, to help us explore and unpack and understand this some more, are two people who are going to make us smarter about COP28. We have with us Dave McGlinchey. Dave is a journalist and a lawyer and leads policy and government relations work at the Woodwell Climate Research Center based in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Dave engages with congressional climate leaders in Washington and has worked with Woodwell scientists in field operations, including a permafrost monitoring station in interior Alaska, all the way to a tropical forest research station on the southern edge of the Amazon. Welcome, Dave. Did I get all of that right?
You did. Thank you so much, Bernice. It's great to be back on the show.
And thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it. And our other guest is Liz Willits. Liz is Planetary Health Policy Director at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Liz has over 20 years' experience mobilizing knowledge and engagement on biodiversity, climate change, pollution, food systems, and community health for marginalized populations. Liz has authored science policy guides for the World Health Organization, the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, and the International Institute for Sustainable Development. Welcome, Liz. Did I get all of that right?
Thank you so much, Bernice. Yes.
And again, thank you both for making time to join us after that long trip to COP. And as soon as you got back from that, you had to get ready for the holidays. So again, thank you so much. I want to start out with you, Liz. Will you explain to our listeners what COP28 is, how it came about, and how is it impacting climate change, our lives, and the world?
Sure. And first, let me just say thank you for having me on the show. And I think this is an important conversation to have. I know we have a very broad listenership to this, and folks are coming from different spaces. So I think explaining this forum is best done very simply.
Yes.
And it's really all about choices. You know, this is a forum for making choices. Governments of 198 countries come together, and they have a space to think about the choices we're making worldwide. So I just want to explain that a little bit. Many decades ago, countries all over the world came together and recognized two main things. They recognized that we have steep and measurable changes in our atmosphere. And then secondly, and even more importantly, countries were starting to report more and more dangerous and costly environmental events, and that they were difficult to deal with. Floods, storms, droughts are affecting the stability of communities, they're affecting economies, political structures, food supplies, and causing a whole number of other stressors. So countries decided they needed a plan, and that plan developed into creating a space for countries to come together and talk about choices to address both of those things. So the other thing that comes along with this is that no one country can do this alone. Countries needed to come together. The changes in the atmosphere affect everyone, just like the air we breathe does not know a state or a country or a regional boundary. The atmosphere is continuous around the world. So choice one that needs to be, you know, discussed is how do you address an atmospheric change? And then pollution that is driving the atmospheric changes is not from one country. It's not from one industry or one company. It is the system of pollution we have created. So choice two is how do we address the system of pollution? COP28 is the 28th time nearly 200 governments have come together to think about the choices to address the steep changes in the atmosphere and to think about addressing the system of pollution we have created. This is so fundamentally connected to the health and well-being of our communities. We need to make good choices, and they need to be effective and efficient.
And so, Liz, I know also that you have been involved in the Lancet Countdown report on health and climate, which we just went into in depth in our first session. But briefly, could you tell us about how the Lancet Countdown report informs or supports discussions and decisions at COP28? What is the intersection of those two things?
Well, the Lancet Countdown, as you know, is a global report that comes out annually. And how does it link to this policy space? Well, you know, in 1992, countries established the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. That is the home of the COPs, the home of COP28. We know it as the UNFCCC. Now, in that original global agreement, countries decided that at the national level, first and foremost, they needed to start looking at adverse effects and ways to address them. And specifically in that agreement, they identified and committed to thinking, kind of taking a new approach and doing integrated planning, stopping to, getting away from silos and thinking that you can, for example, think about agriculture without thinking about the extreme weather and natural hazard patterns and projections that we're anticipating, to stop thinking so siloed that we're not looking at food security and what's happening with our water, to really make integrated plans. Same with assessments, to start doing integrated assessments, supporting scholarship that goes beyond the hard sciences. How does atmospheric change
Temperature storms affect communities and socioeconomic developments. So information is really key to supporting governments to do these things and to act on these predictions at the national level. We need this good information to make sure countries aren't going to be blindsided by the projections and predictions of environmental health risks. So the Lancet Countdown is a robust source of information, and it's a tool that really provides this annual benchmark to support countries in understanding the risks that are coming their way. And we need these types of tools. And most countries don't have the capacity to create this sort of scholarship on their own or to contextualize the changes they're observing at their own national level with what's happening all over the world. And the Lancet Countdown helps to do that. It's a really strong public health tool.
Indeed. And it's, you know, we've been covering it every year since our inception, too. But it seems like, in putting it in very, very, very simplistic terms, is that the Lancet is that resource information that they give you to read or whatever before you go to an important presentation or something like that. It forms the basis of it. It's where you get your correct and in-depth information from, with which to intelligently participate in the big meeting. We just have a minute to go before we go to break. I just want to go to Dave real briefly. And this is just a kind of a general thing in terms of COP28. I know that you have governments, you have companies. What is kind of the structure? And then I gather various organizations or companies are putting on side meetings to help inform decision makers or whatever. Can you talk for just a minute a little bit about that so we get an understanding of how things get done and how things are happening there?
Absolutely, Bernice. So the best way I find to think about the structure of these COP meetings, and COP28 included, is in terms of concentric circles. So there's an inner circle where the negotiations happen. And that's what Liz was referencing a minute ago, talking about 198 countries coming together. And that's been the core of COP. That was the reason it was founded. That's the reason they've convened every year. And that's where they come out with these consensus statements. Around that is this outer concentric circle. And it includes what you just described. There's scientists, there's civil activists, there's academics, there's business people, there's students, there's a whole group outside that, and they hold side events, which, as you just suggested, are intended to kind of drive the conversation forward by informing it. The really interesting thing is that outer circle has grown consistently over the years, and this year was the largest ever. Actually, last year in Egypt was the largest ever with 50,000 attendees. This year was more than 70,000.
And that's a great sign. That's heartening. We're going to go to break, and we'll be back after the break with Liz Willits and Dave McClinchy, who are making us smarter about the COP. Thank you all. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, natural grocers, central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is North Haven Gardens, serving the Metroplex since 1951, the most respected horticultural establishment in North Texas, offering gardening and plant education, concierge services, DIY classes, gifts, and more. Our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 40 years with a holistic approach looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, to our first show of the new year. And today we've been focusing on two very important reports that help to inform policymakers, leaders, and ultimately inform our day-to-day lives as it relates to health and climate change. First part of the show, we looked at the Lancet Countdown report on health and climate change, and now we're looking at the happenings of the recent COP28, our Conference of the Partners. And we are back with Dave McGlinchey with the Woodwell Climate Research Center in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and Liz Willits at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And they are making us smarter already. And again, thank you all for being with us today. So, Liz, I want to move back to you now. Can you tell us about what were the, I guess, the main health risk and opportunities identified there of transition away from fossil fuels as agreed to or as discussed by the COP28 participants?
Well, it sounds more advanced than maybe things
really are.
but I think also it's helpful to think as simple as we can about these things. And so I think the easiest way to think about the risks and opportunities is to just remember that this transition really means we're trying to change the system of pollution. And so the progress we've made on that so far has not been adequate. One highlight, though, out of COP28 is the agreement to a global goal on adaptation. So essentially agreeing that we need to get better about how we're dealing with these atmospheric changes and the increasing natural hazards, extreme weather changes that are happening. And that goal has embedded in it a commitment to measure our efforts based on reduced mortality and morbidity. Now, these are technical public health terms, but to translate, it means we are going to start assessing our efforts to adapt based on the number of people who die or get sick or injured from these atmospheric changes. That is very compelling. It's getting really serious now. And that itself is going to start to, you know, have increasing impacts on our mental health and stressors. And we have to remember that adaptation planning is a very positive thing. It will reduce stress. It will reduce the number of people who die, get sick, or injured. And it's going to also very importantly mean we will start to frame some of our strategy toward addressing the indirect health factors, like working on strategies so that natural hazards don't result in long periods where children are out of school or losing out on education and social development and these sorts of things.
It just seems like there's so very, very, very much we can do by anticipating and planning. But I love what you said. It's going to now reporting is going to be done upon reduced mortality. I think that'll make a difference. It's very similar to our strategies here at Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. It's connecting the environmental issues with health impacts because people care about that for sure. And that's one of the things
Absolutely.
We always, you know, try to deal. Why should people care? So thank you for that. Dave, I want to come back to you now, though, too. In terms of what are the main challenges and opportunities for advancing climate action and adaptation in the U.S., especially after the Biden administration's reentry into the Paris Agreement?
I think that this COP, I've heard this COP described as both groundbreaking and also insufficient. And I think both those things are true. And the reason for that, the opportunities arise because we really did have some groundbreaking moments. Liz just spoke about the movement on adaptation. Hugely significant. We operationalized the Loss and Damage Fund, which was, frankly, remarkable progress at a pace not usually seen.
That's been talked about for years, hasn't it? And nothing's been able to get it going.
And I will say that it was operationalized on day one, which my understanding is longtime observers of the COP process did not see that coming. That was remarkable progress. And that is going to, you referenced this earlier, Bernice, move funding to less developed countries where there's going to be real impacts of climate change and it's going to help deal with some of these irreversible losses. So those are real opportunities. And then the big one was, for the first time, the consensus document coming out of COP acknowledged that fossil fuels is driving the problem. It's our burning of fossil fuels that is really creating this climate change problem. That would seem obvious and an easy thing to say at a climate change conference, but when you're getting 198 countries to agree to it, it's not so easy. So that was real progress. The challenge in the United States and every other country is to turn these top line ambitions and statements into concrete national policies.
Now, just really quickly, though, what was there one thing or how did that loss and damage fund get operationalized on day one? Had people kind of gotten together and already decided that, or was there some tectonic movement of the Earth, or how did that happen?
So there were meetings that took place in the lead-in to COP where they did the work to agree to it. But we've had lead-in meetings before. The fact that this came together really was remarkable and I think a great sign. But again, in terms of opportunities and challenges, they operationalized the Loss and Damage Fund. There was initial funding, a little more than $700 million was committed, but that doesn't come close to kind of the global need for funding to address this on an annual basis. So there's a great opportunity, there's a great breakthrough, but again, insufficient. There needs to be more follow-through.
The other thing that I heard back here in Dallas, Texas, I remember I was hearing daily snippets or daily reports of what was coming out of COP, and I think they seem to have made a big deal in reporting, wherever I was listening to, that health was elevated as a consequence of climate change, which, of course, is what we're all about. So, you know, obviously my ear caught that. Where did that come from, or had that not already been on the table? Because, again, the news outlets here made a big deal of it.
My focus on health and what I, the context I saw it in was there was a lot of discussion about vulnerability and risk and adaptation, and I think all of those folded into a health conversation. But that wasn't as much my focus there, certainly mm-hmm. as others. I'd be interested if Liz had a perspective.
Yeah, Liz, what was your take on that, that the media here was reporting it was a great big issue that the COP was connecting health with climate change?
Oh, well, I just note that, you know, we talked about the attendance. Dave was mentioning the concentric circles and that outer circle. And so I would say that outer circle turned up the volume on the health conversation. And then, you know, in numbers, if you look at those 75,000, almost 2,000 of them were from the health sector. And that is a big shift. 1,900 people who are in the health space, health professionals, attended to be part of that voice.
And Liz, just your take on it, being involved in this field too, what was your take of one of the most significant things to you or that you saw or that you were happy about that came out of COP28?
Well, I think that it's what's being mobilized in the event itself. And there are two things out of that mobilization that are very exciting. And one of those is the conversation is breaking the silos now. And we have movement and mobilization in that outer circle that's never existed, and that is a powerful thing. The second piece, which fewer people recognize because it gets into the technical level, is when the decisions at the COP start introducing public health terms. That becomes a very powerful technical and almost legal aspect that can have trickle-down effects to national policies and to really mandating joint responsibility and collaboration. So introducing mortality into an international environmental law agreement is a whole new territory. And, you know, we hope this continues in this forum and in other forums.
Yeah, I'm real jazzed about that because I know that's one of the things I like to do or ask on each of our shows is ask about stats, statistics. Because, again, people listen to that. Dave, back to you. Last time, we just have a couple of minutes to go because I do know that you are in terms of media and public communication, primarily with policymakers, though. But how can ordinary people access and use the media and public communications platform to learn more and then to take action on climate change?
So, Bernice, I'm going to jump to the take action part because that's mm-hmm. the part I find really exciting. And mm-hmm. I think coming out of COP28, the way general public, the way media can take action is by holding people to account. So these commitments made at COP are voluntary, generally voluntary. The key is that we hold policymakers to account to follow through on the commitments made there. Similarly with corporations, there was a sideline summit on methane, and on methane emissions, and 50 oil companies committed to reducing their flaring and leakage by, I think, in the next 10 years. I got to go back mm-hmm. and look at that. But paying attention to that and making sure there's follow-through is absolutely critical because we've seen these commitments made before on the international stage, and then we've seen them not followed through on. And so remembering what was said, shining a spotlight on it, and staying on top of it, making sure people are being held accountable, is critically important.
Is there a place where people can go and look up and find maybe a concise list all the commitments made? Because in terms of what you said, I think that that is, and that's what we promote here on Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. But the challenge is for people to know what the commitments were that they could and should be holding people accountable for. Are there organizations that would be pushing that out to people?
The first answer I'll give to that is that the amount and quality of reporting that is being done on these events is better and more expansive than ever before. So the information's out there. I personally don't know, maybe Liz does, of one kind of central hub or central repository of all commitments made. But I think that the key would be, you know, for national policymakers to pay attention to what individual national policies are being enacted and being discussed and how those match up to top-level commitments.
Indeed. Briefly, do you know of any place nationally or site or somewhere we can go and just get a very brief list of what the commitments were? Liz, by any chance?
No, I think that's a communication gap that's missing. But I also think, you know, these are very complicated, full of technical terms,
right,
and the list is really long. And so it then would need to be translated to different audiences. And I think different organizations and NGOs and things do that in their own domains.
Okay.
A little more effectively.
Indeed. I'm going to be looking for that, certainly. Thank you all so much. You really have made us smarter, and you've told us about the COP in a way that's interesting and understandable. So I appreciate it. Thank you so much. We've been with Liz Willits and Dave McClinchy, and they really have made us smarter and helped us understand a little bit more about what COP does in our daily lives. And thank you, listeners, for listening in to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. The conversation starts here, but our goal is for to continue in your homes, in your social circles, your workplaces, at the water cooler, and even in the grocery checkout line, so that we can all work together to realize that healthy living is simply not possible without a healthy planet. Our culture is a result of a trillion tiny acts taken by billions of people every day like yourselves. And each of those tiny acts can seem insignificant, but all of them add up one way or the other to the change that we each live through. This is your host, Bernice Butler. Thank you, and join us again for more Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, and listen to any of our past shows on podcast wherever you get yours. Thank you.